Welcome to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine, and I'm on the line with Terry D. Kester and Garland Nix. Welcome to We Act Radio. Welcome to the Raucous Caucus. There are lots of things to talk about today. The Raucous Caucus is officially here, and we are caucusing.
Caucusing. Conferencing.
We are officially caucused. I know, and I suspect Garland also wants to join me in discussing the verdict. I don't think this is something that's going to go away anytime soon, and I think that there's still lots of unexplored issues in the Zimmerman trial. Am I right, Garland? That's what you wanted to chat about today?
Sure we do.
Okay, all right. And then Terry wants to talk about the sabotage of Obamacare. And I would actually go further and say that they're not just sabotaging Obamacare, but they're sabotaging all kinds of progressive legislation, including, for example, Dodd-Frank, which is getting sabotaged just as much as Obamacare. But we'll leave that to your topic at the end of the hour. Let's start with the trial, because at this point, I think virtually everything that could have been said about the trial has largely been said. So I want to focus beyond the trial, not so much on specifically what happened. My focus right now is going to be on post Trayvon Martin. I mean, we can go into, if people want to, we can go into, where I think the jury instructions were flawed, how Florida law is flawed, how the prosecution was flawed, how the judge was flawed, how racism in America is flawed.
racism in America is well and healthy.
Okay, that one's healthy. All right, but George Zimmerman is clearly flawed. There's a lot of flaws. I want to ask you both this question, and that is, where do we go from here? How do we take the lessons learned or not learned in this trial and move forward in a progressive way? I'm hoping to get some kind of optimism out of this. I don't know that I have any reason to expect optimism, but I'm striving for it. So let me start with you, Garland. Where do we go from here? What's the next step as progressives?
Well, Mark, first of all, you're talking to Terry and I, all better known as Gloom and Doom.
Which one's Gloom and which one's Doom?
Today I'll be Gloom.
You can Gloom and Terry can be Doom. All right, Gloom, what is our prospects for the future, Mr. Gloom?
Well, I think what's important here is we have to look beyond the trial at what really this is. I think we're missing the mark when we talk about the legislation, when we talk simply about the court and the justice system. I'll tell you why. I did a little bit of digging. What I found is that when people use the claim stand your ground, it is in the states where it is, it is 11 times more likely to work for a white person than an African American or a Latino or a person of color. And I think what we've got to look at is this. It's bigger than this. The reality of stand your ground is, it's not that it isn't working. It's that it works very well. I think in America, the thing we're missing is that an African American in our society isn't viewed as having ground to stand, basically. So you can't stand your own ground. You look at Marissa Alexander, the woman who shot a wall, and stand your ground didn't work. It's at a very low level of our consciousness, if not pre-consciousness. We're not viewed as having ground to stand, therefore, the people in America aren't going to see African Americans. If a black guy and a white guy or have a confrontation, they're not going to see that. People don't look at this and say, well, Trayvon Martin, the reality is he was the one being chased. He had ground to stand, too. Let's hear some comment, guys.
I don't think everyone here, everyone listening, may know about the Marissa Alexander case. So you want to explain, or should I? Okay, well, Marissa Alexander is an African-American woman who had a history of suffering domestic abuse from her husband. He was arrested for it. He beat her up. She had a restraining order against him. In any case, she had, about 9 days after having a baby, she and I believe her kids were in the home, and he came after her, and she used a gun to warn him to stay away. She didn't shoot him. She shot the wall. I believe it ricocheted up into the ceiling. Anyway, she argued to Florida that she was standing her ground. The state said, nope, you weren't. Offered her 3 years as a plea deal. She said no. Took it to trial. It went to trial, and the jury deliberated, I believe, all of 12 minutes. The Zimmerman case was more than 12 hours, but deliberated all of 12 minutes, said she was guilty, and she was sentenced to 20 years in jail. So people who don't know that now know. And by the way, the prosecutor that went after Marissa Alexander is the exact same prosecutor that went after George Zimmerman. So, give some facts out there. Terry, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I somewhat agree with Garland, somewhat. I think there's a couple of issues that we have to look at. One is we look at justice as being some kind of event. Now, to the individual involved, of course it is an event. But overall, in the system, in a systematic way, in a governmental way, in a societal way, justice is a process, not an event. You're never going to get pure justice. It just don't happen in the life. But viewing it as a process, then it's always imperative to improve the process, to moderate the process, to monitor the process. And I think we've got to change the way we view justice. It just becomes a news item, and it's one way or the other, whether it's O.J. Simpson or Trayvon or whomever. It's just one way or the other. And that's a silly way to look at the situation, except for the individuals involved, and I understand that. The other thing that's really important, I think, to look at is, and Garland's referring to it in a somewhat different way, this is a cultural phenomenon. This is a absurd cultural phenomena. It used to be, in terms of law, that you had the right to protect yourself and your own property in most states and in most places and in most situations, and to protect yourself while you're on your property and if someone, you know, comes into your home or something like that. Other than that, you also had sort of a societal obligation to avoid this kind of confrontation, to avoid this kind of violence, to keep out of these situations, as my father put it bluntly, you know, kick him in the nuts and run. You know, but
or maybe avoid the kick and just run.
But instead of going to this immediate, I'm a hero, I'm going to confront this situation, I'm going to stand my ground because John Wayne did, even though I haven't seen a John Wayne movie in 47 years, I'm going to do it because that's the American way and I have the right and I'm going to shoot you. This is absurd. But this is our culture. It is our culture.
But Terry, let me ask you the question.
This is our culture.
Let me ask you the question that Garland raised. Okay, I agree. Stand your ground's absurd. I'm against vigilantism. I'm all for getting rid of these laws, and we can talk about that later in the broadcast. But let me ask you the question that Garland raised. What if Trayvon Martin had stood his ground? I want you to take the exact two people, George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin, the exact same case. George Zimmerman thinks he doesn't belong. Thinks Trayvon doesn't belong there. Says he looks like he's up to no good. Says these punks always get away. Says expletive. I can't say on air. Begins with an S, four letter word. He's running, goes after him. But the only hypothetical I'm going to change is that instead of George Zimmerman having a gun in his waistband, presume that Trayvon Martin had a legal gun in his waistband. I don't know whether a 17-year-old can. If you want to make him 18,
well, let's just say he was a year older. Let's say he was a year older and he was.
Say he was 18. Say he was 18, or maybe even a 17-year-old can have a concealed gun and weapon in Florida. I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me. But that's all I want to change in the scenario. And this is my question for Terry. All I'm going to change is who has the gun. Okay. So then the rest stays the same. The 911 tapes stay the same. And what happens is they get in a scuffle. Okay. And Trayvon Martin shoots George Zimmerman, and he says, I did it in self-defense. And in this example, okay, I'll give you one more change. Trayvon Martin has a bloody nose and some marks on the back of his head. What do you think, Terry, would have been the result?
I don't think there's an easy answer. I mean, I think, now, if they're in Texas, there's an easy answer. You know, in Mississippi, there's an easy answer. In Florida, there might be an easy answer. In Detroit, it's not an easy answer. In Chicago, it's not an easy answer. You know, it depends. I think it's too simplistic a question. I really honestly do. I think the odds
answer is
are,
we can't know what happened that night because no one was there except for the living person. I mean, Zimmerman was there. Trayvon's dead. If you reverse the situation, Trayvon would be there. Zimmerman would be dead. And, you know, we'll give the exact same witness accounts.
The first thing that happened is obviously you would not get nearly the news coverage. You would not get, as much protestation.
Wait, you don't think you don't think when a black person kills a white person, you get as much news coverage?
I mean, in the sense of the verdict is what I was thinking. I was a little bit ahead of myself there, but in that situation, there is innate prejudice in our society. There is innate, inherent racism in our society. I think anybody would deny that. It's just not paying attention. I'm not sure that is the way to look at it, though. I'm really not sure that's the way to look at it.
What is the way to look at it?
The broader picture.
The numbers do say that Trayvon Martin would have been locked up that night charged with murder, that he wouldn't have gotten it. The numbers, I'll tell you why. As I said, the numbers say that had Trayvon Martin claimed stand your ground, well, he would have been 11 times less likely than George Zimmerman to be successful. And George Zimmerman didn't even claim stand your ground, and the juror was told to use stand your ground to make a decision. That's the fact of the matter. So even though he didn't have it, the judge said to the jury, well, that's okay, let's give it to him anyway. So the numbers say, well, let me say this. The numbers are glaring. When you look at who gets the death penalty, it depends what color is the victim and what color is the shooter. So, I mean, the numbers overwhelmingly say when you look at who gets the longest sentence for the exact same crime. So what the numbers say is that we do have a legal justice system that, like the politics, reflects our society, the weaker person. Terry, let me tell you this. If there's a rich person and a poor person shoots them, the poor person's going to jail. If it's a poor person that shoots a rich person, the rich person, O.J. Simpson, he was rich. Right. Didn't matter what color he was rich. So ultimately, we have a criminal justice system that reflects our society of those who are viewed on a lower level in our existing caste system are always going to be the loser.
Garland, what you're referring to, let me just give a little context, because sometimes we don't give context. There is a famous case, went before the United States Supreme Court, I believe in the late 90s, I could be wrong about the day, but within the last 10-15 years, where they did a systematic study of everyone that got the death penalty of murders. And they looked at blacks killing blacks, whites killing whites, blacks killing whites, and whites killing blacks. And what they found is that the race of the victim often determines the result. Interestingly enough, it's not so much that blacks killing blacks got it worse off than whites killing blacks, but blacks killing whites and whites killing whites actually were more likely to be imprisoned than people, white or black, killing blacks. Apparently, when the victim is white, people care more than when the victim is black. And that study was brought to the United States Supreme Court. It was statistically significant, meaning that it was highly unlikely to be random error. When you say something statistically significant, it means it has a less than 5% chance likely to be random error. And they brought this to the United States Supreme Court. It's the United States Supreme Court because all across the nation, the death penalty is being unequally applied based on the race of the victim, you should suspend the death penalty. And Supreme Court said, oh, that's well and interesting, but we can't rule based on the aggregation of cases all across the nation. We can only take it by case, case denied. But the study, the scientific methodology of that study has never been challenged, and that's what Garland was referring to. I just wanted to give that context for people that didn't have it. Terry, you were going to say something. Go ahead.
Well, you know, we're caught in a vicious circle here. We truly are. You know, I don't doubt those statistics. I know those statistics are relatively accurate, and the situation is accurate. I know that racism exists, and at a subconscious level and at a conscious level. It's everywhere. I've been in restaurants in Virginia with a friend who was Samoan, and we did not get served for an hour and a half.
Wow.
left. You know, because he was a little bit, you know, not white, and I have no, and it was in the rural part of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know it exists. At the same time, I have to look at my own personal life experience to evaluate things, and I have lived darn near in every city, or lived in or worked darn near in every major city in the United States, and
I guess when you live 2,000 years, you get around. Is that what you're saying?
You do. I've lived in a lot of cities in Europe too, but that's another story. But you know, it's in my, I've lived in ghettos. I've lived in ghettos where I've been only one or two of whites, you know, in the whole ghetto, particularly in Philadelphia and somewhat in Chicago. And my experience has been I have rarely been in a semi-violent or confrontational situation with whites. I have been challenged by blacks 100 times. I really honestly have. And the only reason I'm saying that,
well, Terry, maybe it's because you were the minority in their neighborhood. In other words,
well, that not necessarily, because I mean the same thing happened in New York, you know, constantly. But my point is, Mr. Obama, President Obama, made this point about the culture of violence for legitimate historical reasons and frustration that is seems to be in the African community, African-American community. He referred to that. I'm taking his idea, and I think there's some value in understanding that. Not that that has anything to do with justice. It is perception, because there is a certain reality within it.
See, I would argue
but
the culture of violence...
So far it, beyond that.
I would argue it's...
We are now just a totally violent nation where we'll shoot anybody that gets in our way.
I would argue the culture of violence is in with poverty, that people who are poor often do desperate things. I don't think you'd find a culture of violence in a middle-class black neighborhood or a bougie black neighborhood. Do you find it in the ghetto? You do, but I also think you find it in poor white areas. I think poor people are desperate and violent. But I know Garland wants to respond.
I was about to say there's another study. There was another study that I wish I had access to, so I could tell our listeners exactly how to get to it. But at any rate, it's exactly what you're saying. What they found was all these studies where you say, "Well, black people are more likely to this and that, and violence and arrest rate." And when they said, "Well, let's not separate people by race. Let's separate them by education level and by economic level." They found that it leveled right out. The issue was there's a lot more poor black people.
Right.
So if you don't say, well, let's look at black people or white people, you say, well, let's look at people who live below the poverty rate, all the numbers level right out. So the problem is we are looking at it from the wrong perspective. It is, and time and time again in America, there are a lot of things that are economic. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying there isn't racism. I'm simply saying that idea that black people are more violent. No, they're oftentimes more poor. The other thing is this, and this is what I want to understand. There is a difference in it between how black people and white people are viewed. Number one, with Trayvon Martin, it was simple. It worked like this. You don't, because George Zimmerman said you don't belong around here. What that means is you don't belong around here. Your very existence in this area is evidence of a crime, number one. Number two, and all black people know this, inherently know this. If you are a white guy and you got a ponytail and you got a, you know, an old beat up car and you got a bunch of, you know, some missing teeth, et cetera, and you're pulled over by the police, you're probably not going to be treated reasonably and fairly, and they're going to be scared of you.
Yep, that's true.
Okay, but if you're a rich white guy in a Mercedes, well, then they're going to treat you totally different.
That's true.
The difference is this. It doesn't matter as a black person. You don't get that same different treatment because you're a middle-class black person, you're a wealthy black person, or you're a poor black person. With black people, it's all the same. We don't get the same economic, unfortunately.
Let me challenge that, Carl.
Economic advantages.
I'm going to challenge that because I think it's like a point system, all right? I would say that if you're black, you lose 2 points. And if you're poor or you look unwell-dressed, like you talked about the guy with his teeth missing or uneducated, you also lose 2 points. I dare say that very poor black people are treated worse than black people who are wearing a nice suit in a Mercedes. So I would argue that race is a factor, yes, but also poverty is a factor. And if you've got both, you got both factors. But I don't think it's true that a rich black guy in a Mercedes is treated the same as a poor black guy with teeth missing
I'll even go one further. If he's driving down 95, he is more likely to be pulled over and searched for drugs. That is why the Maryland State Police lost the case. That's why they, settled the case in Maryland, because the rich, wealthy black guy, one of them who is the guy is, I think he's going to be, he's just been nominated for some high federal judge position, the guy that challenged the state police in Maryland with the ACLU. They found if you're a wealthy black guy, he was in a brand new Cadillac, or if you're in a new Mercedes or BMW or something like that, on 95, you're more likely to pull people.
Even if he's well dressed. Well-dressed
the guy was an attorney at the time, and he was with his family in a brand new Cadillac. And you know what? One of the things that surfaced, a memo in Maryland State from Maryland State Police that was circulated that had a description of who to look for. Black people in late model luxury cars.
Wow.
A memo that said that.
Wow.
You're not going to see a memo anywhere in America that says we want to look for white people in late model luxury cars to pull over and search.
I agree.
But guys.
Go ahead, Terry.
we got to concentrate someone on this economic issue, because I think that's the foundation. And you also got to, you know, we're talking about racism here. We've left out the whole Latino Hispanic situation.
That's true. The last
person I'd want to be in America right now is Latino. Absolutely.
You think they're treated worse than African Americans? Not that we should have a paint off or anything.
In the sense that, by golly, as soon as you are Latino and as soon as you walk on the street, you are illegal, period. That is the judgment. That is the ruling. And by golly, if you get pulled over and you don't have your license, and I have some friends who are Latino who don't have their driver's license because they wouldn't dare go to get one, because if they get one, they're going to be locked up, you know, and they're going to be deported. And if they're pulled over for anything, they're going to be locked up and deported. There is a inherent it's bigger than racism. I don't even know how to describe it. It's bigger than racism in America that is just, I don't know what it is. It's absurd because now we've not, you know, whites aren't even 50% of the population, so I don't know what the heck they're fighting
for. Well, let me follow up on that, because I know of a case of a guy, Latino guy, born in California. He was a trucker, and he, you know, went states all the time, and he was in Arizona, and he was pulled over, I don't know, for speeding or what. And he showed his California driver's license, and they said in Arizona, "Oh, I'm sorry, that's not good enough, Jose. Where's your birth certificate?" And he said, "I don't carry my birth certificate with me. I was born in Cerritos, California. You know, here's the hospital." And they're like, "Sorry." And they took him in, for 4 hours until his wife could drive from California to Arizona with the birth certificate to get him out. So there's definitely cases of anti-Latino prejudice too. But my general question.
At a degree we don't even talk about, and just a simple fact now, in case people weren't aware of it, now when we're flying people out of the country, we fly them not, we don't push them across the border anymore. We take them all the way to the furthest, southernest part of Mexico, so they've got even less chance of possibly getting back. And that's a fact. We literally do that. The Marshal Services takes them as far out of the country as they can. And there are hundreds of Latinos, hundreds if not thousands of Latinos, who have done absolutely nothing wrong, except they were here illegally or their green card had expired or whatever that had expired.
But
they get locked up, they put in an institution, you can't have contact with them, you never get to see them, they get no defense, and they are deported.
Here's the difference, though, and I want to see if Garland agrees with me. Here's the difference. Every immigrant group in America, except the English, has been discriminated against. When the Irish first came, they were discriminated against. When the Germans first came, they were discriminated against. Then America accepted Irish and Germans, and they went after Jews and Italians. Jews and Italians were discriminated against. And then Jews and Italians seemed to be accepted, and Latinos and Asians, okay, they're next on the list. But African Americans are uniquely, I would argue, different, because I think Latinos and Asians will eventually be accepted into community, just like Jews, Italians, Irish, and Germans were, you know, 50 and 100, 150 years before. The difference, I think, is because of the legacy of slavery and because of, frankly, Southern guilt. And I don't know. I think African Americans are uniquely different from all the immigrant groups, including Latinos. And I'm not denying all the prejudice against Latinos today, but I think it's because they're the latest group of immigrants. I think in 50 years, a lot of that's going to go away. Whereas I think race is the American question of American history. It's the only question that we had 300 years ago that we still have today. I mean, we're not arguing about tariffs anymore or King George or lots of issues have gone away. This one remains with us. I think it's unique, and I don't know if Garland agrees with me on this.
Absolutely. I mean, there were, you know, the economic engine of our country early on was totally and completely built on racism and built on slavery and built on, you know, making sure that the poor white Americans believed that the black people were below them, number one, so that the rich could continue to have slaves, and number two, so they wouldn't gripe and realize that the fact that they had slaves was actually taking money from them. It's different. I mean, right now, as an example, an entire party, the Republican Party, one of their pillars is states' rights. States' rights was only about slavery. States' rights was only about racism. It was used to argue for slavery and the expansion of slavery. It was used to argue against anti-lynching laws. It's always been used time and time again. If we even look at the social safety net, FDR could only get it through because he changed it so that black people couldn't get it. Today, people are trying to take it apart. And they're using the argument, which is a false argument, that only poor black people are taking, you know, can take advantage of social safety net. So I say race is one of the foundational problems in America that is like a cancer that's been eating us from the inside out. And the sad thing is now it is so popular to say, well, it's over, we got a black president. Oh, it's so much better, we've come so far. We've gotten really, really good at denial, in my opinion.
I think it's even, but I still think it's broader. I think it's broader, and I'm not denying a thing. I'm not disagreeing with a thing that Garland has just said or that you've said either, Mark. But there is something about the human condition that is obscenely tribal. And whether it's here in the United States or whether it's in the Mideast or wherever it is continually the problem that keeps on driving us to war, to racism, and everything else. And somehow or other, we've got to get past this individualistic or tribalistic viewpoint that we have of the world. We've got to get past that. And I don't know how the hell we're going
to
do
that. Let me suggest a way to get past tribalism.
Go ahead, Garland.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can I ask you one quick question?
Yeah.
The people never, they go to the first part. The Irish were discriminated against, the Italians, the Jews, the Catholics, on and on and on, right? Of all the groups that were discriminated against. Let me ask you a question. By whom?
By the majority white population. At the beginning, it was white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, and then they slowly let more and more people in, Catholics and Irish and Germans and Italians and arguably Jews and arguably Asians. But the majority population, people.
Did they really
the early part?
Hold on, one at a time. Go ahead, Garland.
Did they really let them in, or did they say there's this so-called melting pot and the WASP people at the top, and then the term they used to use was white ethnics?
Well, here's the thing. I actually think, for example, the Irish, who were the first ones discriminated against, the Germans, actually. The Irish and the Germans were discriminated against in the 1840s. Today, I dare say there's zero anti-Irish or anti-German discrimination. So they fully made it. I think the later in history you go, I mean, Jews and Italians, I think there's certainly some discrimination against Italians, more discrimination against Jews. But I think, you know, that's turn of the century discrimination. They've largely made it, but not to the extent of Irish and Italians. And you can go further down the line. I think the longer a group has been here, but actually what you say, Garland, meshes with what I was going to say to Terry about the melting pot. Terry asks, how do we get out of tribalism? And let me suggest to you that the best way to get out of tribalism is the melting pot. When I say melting, I don't mean just or even primarily cultures. I mean intermarriage. I mean desegregation.
Yes.
I mean white and black people marrying each other, talking to each other, being friends with each other. The same. I would argue that the reason why Germans and Italians no longer discriminate in America is because nobody even notices when a German white person marries an English or a Irish. There's still some Catholic Protestant difference, but even that seems pretty low these days. Jews are intermarrying more and more. I just think that if there were less segregation and more intermarriage and more intermixture of cultures, eventually you come to a country like Brazil where black and white doesn't make that much of a difference anymore because of the culture, or Mexico where there's still racism, but the Spanish and the Indians have intermarried and there's less likely to be. But I don't know, maybe.
And to throw away gloom and doom. I mean, that is something that is happening in America.
It is, slowly.
Interracial marriage has increased phenomenally in the last few decades and is continuing to increase. And I think in a way you're right. It is happening. It's happening naturally without anybody asking it to happen. It just is. And I think that is a beautiful sign, and maybe eventually we'll all turn out to be some nice little golden color and,
slightly brown. Well, I'll be my color. I'm in between the color of you two, and I've got this middle. I'm not black now. I don't like to think of myself white because I'm pretty brown actually. When you think about it, Garland, what do you think about this intermixture?
Think one of the things, if you listen to our discussion that I'm hearing, is this. Well, here's what's something interesting. In America, white people are separated by ethnicity. The Irish American, whatever American. Black people are separated by race. As an example, a Jamaican guy walks by, they say that's a black guy. You know, the Panamanian guy walks back, there's a black guy. Here's the bottom line. I don't know that much about the Jamaican culture. I know for the Italian, original Italian culture and the Irish culture, my culture is every bit as separate between those two as the Jamaican culture. I know nothing about it. Black people are identified by race for the most part, and black people and white by the color of their skin, which is race.
See, I actually think there's some difference between.
I want you guys to think about. It tells you a lot about America. why do we call President Obama black?
Yeah, he's half black, half white.
Who decided that he's black?
Right. I've argued this for a long time. No one's really listened to me, but I've argued that this man is half black, half white, and should be considered half black, half white. But no one seems to want to make that argument.
Well, he doesn't. There is not even a dispute that he's black.
He doesn't even make that point himself, and I wish he did. You know, at least not strongly, and at least not in these situations. I mean, he is not black, as a matter of fact. He is
half black.
Yeah.
He is half black.
You know, and it doesn't matter, which is beautiful. I mean, it used to be that if, you were half Jewish, for instance, boy, you were off to, whatever labor camp they could put you in, But
The Nazis actually, if you were a quarter Jewish, although Jewish law actually makes a nice fine distinction. If your mother's Jewish, you're 100% Jewish, and if your mother's not Jewish, you're 100% not Jewish. And that at least it's a clear line. Right. It's a clear line, and then actually the reform movement now accepts if your father's Jewish, you're Jewish too.
And how many people do you know that you ask them, and they'll say, "Oh, what is your ethnicity?" My mother was German, my father was Italian. Okay, whatever. But if you're black, my mother was black, and my father was white. It came from the slavery. If there's one drop of black blood in you, 1%, then you're considered black for the purposes of maintaining supremacy over black people.
Yeah, but Garland, let me ask you this, though. I just want to ask you this. When it comes to a positive role model, Tiger Woods, before he had the problem with the women, okay? Let's ignore that. But Tiger Woods, when he said, I think he's only a quarter black and a quarter white and half Asian. I think that's what he is. I forget. I may have a quarter mixture. But he's clearly white, black, and Asian. And when he said that, black people pushed back and said, "Now wait a minute. Here's a brother that's not admitting he's black." And he's Tiger Woods said, "I'm a quarter black," or whatever percentage he was. But black people pushed back too on that, Garland, when it's a positive role model.
Why don't we just get honest and require everybody to be honest? There's nobody on this damn planet that isn't a mutt.
Right.
There is not.
Right. And we all came from Africa anyway. We're all black.
Not a mutt.
We're all black because our ancestors are all, the human race came from Africa, period. Whether you're, if you're Icelandic, your people originally came from Africa. No matter how white you are.
I mean, we're all black, brown, Asian, and everything else. I know, the only thing I know for sure is that I have Romanian blood, gypsy blood in me, and I'm as much a mutt as anybody can possibly be. My older brother is dark skin, black hair. My father was dark skin, black hair. We're mutts.
The other thing that I was just at the Smithsonian in the Natural History Museum, and something that I think I knew, but it was just interesting to point out, they were talking about the human race. 99.9% of the genes of every human being on Earth are identical.
Exactly.
99.9%. Our differences are so magnified, and yet, we are clearly the same species.
The real thing. You point out something very important, and not only are our differences magnified, our differences are political tools.
Sure.
And, whether it's, Jesse Jackson or whether it's some rightist, Mississippian, it's the same thing. Our racism, our differences, that 0.1%, whatever it is a political tool. And we've got to recognize that people use that strictly for their own personal power. And we've got to reject every single argument.
Racism, the other thing is that racism that we have to acknowledge is that it has a tremendous social effect, and it creates a tremendous disadvantage for black people. Let me give you an example. My daughter was a very, very bright child. She's 24. When she was in third grade, her teacher called me. We live in is mostly white. Well, we need to talk. What, Mr. Nixon? Well, we think she should be in special education. I said, why? They talked to me for an hour and never came up with one legitimate reason why she should be in special education. And I said, no, thank you. And I had heard many times, I had heard from parents that said, in the white school system, they always try to put black kids in special ed. And I saw it with my own eyes with my daughter. Now, keep in mind, in May, my daughter graduated magna cum laude from the University of Baltimore.
Congratulations.
She got like one B in the last 3 years. When she was in school, I hadn't had the background and the education and the knowledge to know, to review it on myself, to know all the other things. And I just said, okay, they would put her in special education. They would have taught her slower than the other kids. She would have fallen behind, and they would have used that justification that by the time she got out of high school, she'd have been so far behind the kids, even though she was a very smart kid. Now, this happens so frequently. These kinds of things actually keep the black Americans, you know, this type of racism, this type of, you know, kind of an underlying racism actually pushes black people back, and then people use that as a reason to say, well, you know, they're farther behind us because they're just not as smart as we are.
There is that vicious circle.
So, Garland, what advice would you give, and then we're going to take a break, and I want to get to Terry's topic, but just what advice would you give to a black parent like yourself who is facing like the special education or something where you consider something unfair? Because here's the problem I see. When black people cry race, they may well be right, but that's not it's not an argument that white people are listening to or really want to hear. So how do you deal with it? I mean, you just sort of fought back and said, no, my daughter doesn't belong in special education, and eventually they relented? I mean, what would you
say? No, I had to give permission. I said, absolutely not. What are you doing? She's a smart kid. I mean, it was insane. I still am flabbergasted how a child, at the time, she had all A's and B's.
That's crazy.
A's and B's.
Yeah.
But she should go to special education. And I just thought, man, if I was an uneducated person, if I didn't know, if I believed, well, they're the school system, they must know what they're talking about, my daughter's life would have been screwed.
Wow.
She's doing so well today.
That is an amazing story. All right, gentlemen, I want you.
How many people does that happen to?
Yeah, and congratulations, by the way. You have every right to be a proud father of your daughter who graduated magna cum laude. So congratulations to your daughter.
That is nice.
All right, when we come back, I know that Terry wants to move on to his topic. He wants to talk about the sabotage of Obamacare. I would argue that's not the only thing that's being sabotaged, but we'll get back with Terry's topic when we come back. If you want to call in, folks, it's 202. 407-9889, a different number today, 202-407-9889. We'll be right back with more of the Raucous Caucus right after this. Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine. We are here at WEAC Radio Studios. I believe I have on the air...
Terry Gasker.
And...
Well,
and we are here, and that's good. So, gentlemen, we want to move on to Terry's topic, and you wanted to talk about the sabotage of Obamacare.
Yeah, because I don't think most Americans are really aware of what's going on. I mean, you hear the headlines, you know, good old Harry Reid, you know, making the situation totally ridiculous by saying, you know, the House has, you know, tried to repeal the Obamacare 33 times, and they have failed every time. Failed is his word. Yeah, well, that's true, but that has nothing to do with what Congress is doing to Obamacare. And in the last couple of years, there are over 12 separate laws that have passed that nibble away at Obamacare, taking funding from it, taking funding from agencies that are indirectly would be supporting Obamacare, removing, you know, operational facilities in terms of, you know, how many people can be hired and everything else. There are just bill after bill after bill, and you can go to the Washington Post if you haven't seen it and check it there. There's a fact check thing there. 12 different bills have been passed to just erode Obamacare so that it will not work. The other fact that people aren't aware of, and I'm only aware of this because of a conversation I had last night with some human resources people in law firms, that the law itself is so sloppily written and there is so much duplication and confusion in it that no matter what choice you make as a small corporation, you are doing something that is against another part of the law.
Well, let me deal with your first question. Let me deal with the first part first, because there's kind of separate issues.
But the second part is significant only because I think that confusion in the law is deliberate. It was forced upon those who composed the law.
Well, okay, let's just deal with them one step at a time. We'll get to both of them. But the first thing you say is that there's bills passed that are taken away from Obamacare. Are you saying bills passed the House, or are you saying bills passed by the House, passed by the Senate, and signed by the President? In other words, new laws that are taken away from Obamacare.
House passed, signed into law, the Consolidated Appropriation Act of 2012, supposedly nothing to do with Obamacare. This measure rescinded $400 million... in co-op funds and $10 million in funds for the Independent Patient Advisory Board. It's always hidden in some other bill, be it defense, be it appropriations, and yes, Obama has signed them.
Okay. All right.
This is what is what's going on, and it isn't. These are laws that have passed.
And that's actually typical of the way that Congress works its way when they want to sneak. They sneak something into
them.
Right. The Consolidated Appropriations Bill, and I remember from when I was in Congress, they tend to be something like 15,000 pages long. And you stick one line in on page 8,932, line B. Nobody sees it except the person who wrote it in.
Right, and there's another, for instance, there's a law in the 1099 Taxpayer Protection and Repayment of Exchange Subsidy Overpayments that was in there to supposedly help finance health care law. Well, that has been removed. It has to do with 1099s and to do with taxes. It has nothing directly to do with Obamacare. This bill, the House passed and signed into law, Comprehensive 1099 Taxpayer Protection and Repayment Exchange Subsidy Overpayment Act. Now, that's a law the media paid a lot of attention to. But that was repealed, and that took funding that was designed to help finance the health care law. There's just case after case where these things are hidden, and even with this conference that Senate had, you know, they still allow people to put things into laws through amendments and not even be identified as to who's doing it. And it is being so eroded that by the time Obama finishes his presidency, or by the time we're in the 2014 elections, Obamacare will look like a disaster.
Well, and of course, this is not just Obamacare, as I was pointing out. They're doing this with Dodd-Frank.
No.
They're doing this basically any time they lose something, they lose a vote. And of course, these are very hard fought votes. Let's not forget how hard fought that these were. It took a year, and everyone, they argue they're fighting too hard and so forth. And now they're just working behind the back door to make sure it dies.
And there's also an aspect, you know, and I mentioned it briefly, but I mean, you can check with the Common Cause. They had wonderful articles about it recently, and how the lawyers for pharma, say the Pharmaceutical Association, for the AMA, et cetera, they will write things into the law that they know will be challenged.
Tell us more about what these law firms are telling you.
That they have been trying to implement, and Oregon probably has gone further with implementing the health care law than any state in the union. I mean, they really have an excellent program in terms of marketing and everything else for the exchanges, etc. But at the same time, the law itself is so complex that the lawyer, and this is the lawyers that I was speaking to last night with this one particular firm, that they have tried to figure out how to do it, and they can't find a way to do it without being in violation of some other law that's within the health care law.
What do you think, Terry, about the fact that they've delayed implementation of the work requirement in Obamacare for a year? Are you saying actually that you think, given the mess, that you support the delay?
Supporting the delay, I don't know. I can't claim, I'm not a lawyer, so I cannot claim to know enough to say that everything that's been done is justified. But what I have been told, again, is simply you cannot implement the law as regarding for a small businesses, you know, like, and this was particularly a law firm that was trying to figure it out. And if you complete everything that you're supposed to complete to qualify for, you know, you're giving your employees certain benefits, et cetera, you will, by completing the laws that are required for Obamacare, you also will be you'll be doing something illegal that is stated somewhere else in the law, in the health care law. It is literally that confusing.
That's why we need good regulation to implement this thing. And of course, businesses are fighting tooth and nail, and state governments are fighting tooth and nail. Let me give Garland, who's been off the phone in La La Land for a while. Garland, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, it's interesting. I was watching C-SPAN the other day, and there was some Tea Party guy on there, and it was amazing how many callers were ripping him apart about his opposition to Obamacare.
Really?
The people in from New York City saying, look, I was paying $1,000 a month, and now under this new exchange, I'm going to pay $3. People calling saying, you know, me and my husband and my daughter never had it. Now, for the first time, you know, in our adult lives, we're going to have health care. I really believe this. The Republicans have been fighting health care. Well, they don't believe in that kind of stuff anyway, you know, social safety net. But one of the things, it's not because they don't think it'll work. It's because they think it will. And because they know people will like it. And once people get it, and, you know, there'll be some bumps in the road in any major bill like this and getting it fully implemented. But the fact of the matter is a whole bunch of people, millions and millions, are going to get a card that says you can go to the doctor now and you can get your prescription filled that never had that before. And once they get it, they ain't never giving it up. Obamacare, mate, there'll be some bumps and bruises, but it's going to work. And I predict that 10 years from now, et cetera, when people look back, that will be what they'll remember Barack Obama for. When you look back at FDR and you look at what is he really, you know, of course, World War II, but people really think about the social safety net stuff.
Yeah, and when they think about Lyndon Johnson, they think about the war on poverty, they think about civil rights, and they think about Medicare.
My question, Garland, is were you on the air when I was listing these laws, these 12 laws that have been passed by the House that undermine the system?
Yeah, and I expect the Tea Party people to do that. Well, you know what's interesting about that?
But the point is, these 12 laws passed so far, and I'm sure there are many more, these laws that are hidden, is making it more and more difficult to administrate the health care law.
Right.
So there's going to be more and more confusion. I hope you're right, Garland, that everybody is going to want to buy into it, and that's the hope of the Obama administration. But there's so much undermining going that the administration is going to be confused, so it's going to become a bureaucratic hassle, which is exactly what the Republicans want, so that they can stand up and say, see, by 2014, your life isn't better.
Let me suggest to you an answer to all of this, I'm of mixed minds, as you know, about Obamacare. I do think it's better than the current system, but I don't really like tying it to employment, and I obviously feel the 35 nations that have universal health care, they all pay way less than we do, they live longer, and life is easy. You simply go to any doctor of your choice, you present your insurance card, and you get medical care. Wow. So it seems to me that if we ever take back the House, which I think is conceivable if the Republicans, I mean, I think their approval rating is something like 9% now. I know they've gerrymandered everything, but that doesn't mean we can't win 54, 55% and actually take back the House. It seems to me the answer for Democrats, you know, Medicare for all seems too extreme for people. So how about this? What if we do a year plan where we say, all right, Medicare in 2014 extends if you're 64 years old. And in 2015, if you're 63, and then 62, 61. And my guess is in 5 years, all the people who are just joining will be, wow, this is good stuff. And eventually we'll just get Medicare for all and get rid of all the complications of Obamacare thrown in by whatever legislative requirement it took to get Ben Nelson of Nebraska to get past the filibuster and just simply have a system Medicare that the vast majority of Americans support and that's working pretty well. You could even raise some premiums on Medicare. I'm fine with that. You could make rich people pay all the way up, that there wouldn't be a cap on it. But basically, fix the system we have now rather than put in something new that I think people are scared about.
There's no question, Mark, that you, Garland, and myself should be running the country.
Of course.
I mean, you've just proved it, you know, but unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, let's throw this in there before we go real quick, and that is, Mark, you say maybe we'll take back the House. I don't know if you've been looking at the demographic shifts, and I'm talking about including young people, Latinos, African-Americans, et cetera. By 2024, the Republicans are wiped out. They have nothing.
That be nice?
They don't have by 2024.
Well, good. 10 years.
Done. And which is a short period in politics. And you know what? At that point, we get it all.
Okay. Well, good. That's good. But let me suggest to you, it is, except that here's the problem I see. All right. And I see it every single mid-year, off-year election. Do young people and African Americans and Latinos and Asians and all the Obama supporters come out every 4 years? They do. Do they come out every 2 years? They don't. We have an election right here in Virginia on the odd years, which is even more obscure than the off-year congressional years. And I dare say 20% of Virginians are going to vote, and the guy that could win is crazy. I mean, he is a radical right wing. He's far to the right of Rick Perry of Texas. I mean, this guy, Cuccinelli, he's kind of kooky. I mean, we can go into how anti-gay he is, or how anti-union he is, or how anti-women he is. He has this whole long history, but people don't vote. So my last question, and I'll just start with you, Garland, is how the heck do we get the Obama coalition? Blacks vote greater than whites every 4 years, but they vote far less on the off year. We're never going to take back Congress in 2014 if we don't get the Obama coalition. I mean young people who vote every 4 years. I mean Latinos who vote every four. This coalition isn't voting except in presidential elections. What do we do about it?
Well, I think the Republican Party is really helping that along with, you know, their opposition to immigration and all the abortion bill. So I think they're giving us a boost.
So you think we're going to get high turnout in 2014? I sure hope you're right.
I think we're going to get decent turnout. I think it'll be a surprise. I think it'll be better than we've had in a while.
All right.
I hope so also, because the right wing is pushing such crazy laws and crazy steps. I can give you a classic example. In the state of Washington, there is a right wing group that is getting on the ballot that it is illegal to put light rail anywhere near Vancouver. I mean, this is insane, they are getting these things on the ballot.
It is insane.
And they've gotten in similar things that have passed, because, again, people don't turn out for these small elections, but the nut jobs turn out.
Well, if there's one thing that we can make clear, then it's please get out and vote. Don't miss a single election. I am proud of the fact that I don't believe I've missed a single election since I was 18 years old, except for the one time I was out of town for both the absentee ballot and the real election. Other than that, every primary...
I haven't missed an election since the Magna Carta.
Since the Magna Carta. Did you vote in the Magna Carta election?
I did. I was one of the few that was able to vote on it.
All right. Okay. That's good. That's good. Yeah. So please get out and vote. Thank you, Garland. Thank you, Terry. Terry, if they wanted to find you, they look under a rock. How do they find you?
Leavenworth.
Okay. Is that where you are? Leavenworth Prison?
Yeah, Dr. Dr. of Democracy, AOL.com.
Oh, okay. All right. So not Leavenworth. All right. Garland, where can they find you?
GarlandIn@gmail.com, Twitter @GarlandNixon, or Facebook me.
All right.
Just don't try to call him. It doesn't work.
That's true, particularly not from a radio studio. I am, of course, at Mark Levine Talk. My website's marklevinetalk.com. I'm also on Facebook. You can join my fan page. You can be my friend. I'll friend you. I'll even claim to know you, even though I don't. But that's just the way it works. Thank you both for coming here on the Raucous Caucus. Coming up, the inside scoop. I'm going to replay in its entirety President Obama's, I think, one of the best speeches I think I've heard him say, which is this very frank discussion about race. If you haven't heard that, you can hear it right here on the radio, and then I'm going to talk about it later on. If you want to call in, it is 202-407-9889. It's a different call-in number. You can also call toll-free. My call-in, 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back with the Inside Scoop right after this.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Terry.